I must now either forswear my obligation to the man who saved my life, or forswear my promise to the House of Bel Oster to keep its business as private as possible.
You must do neither, said the Don, and perhaps I can aid you directly in the pursuit of your master's business. Do you not see? If Don Jacobo does not know of your presence here, what obligation do you have to him? Clearly you are set here upon business, a plan, a scheme, a proposal of some sort. You're here to initiate something, or else you'd have your connections already in place. Don't be angry with yourself. This is all plain logic. Is it not true?
Fairwhite looked down and nodded reluctantly.
Then here it is. Although I am not as wealthy as Don Jacobo, I am a man of substantial means, and we are in complementary lines of business, are we not? Attend me tomorrow on my barge at the Shifting Revel. Make your proposal to me. Let us discuss it thoroughly.
There was a wicked gleam in Don Salvara's eyes. It could be seen despite the brightness of the sun overhead.
As you are indebted to me, repay this obligation by agreeing only to attend. Then, free of obligation, let us discuss business to our mutual advantage. Do you not see that I have a vested interest in taking whatever opportunity you present away from Jacobo, even if he never learns of it? Especially if he never learns of it. And am I not bold enough for your tastes? I swear your face grows longer as though by sorcery. What's wrong?
It is not you, Don Lorenzo. It is merely that the hands beneath are suddenly too generous once more. We have a saying that undeserved good fortune always conceals a snare.
Don't worry, Master Fairwhite. If it's really business that you want to discuss, never doubt that there will be hard work and bitter troubles enough waiting for us down the road. Are we in agreement, then? Will you dine with me tomorrow morning, take in the Shifting Revel, and discuss your proposal with me?
Fairwhite swallowed, looked Don Salvara in the eyes, and nodded firmly.
There is great sense in what you propose, and perhaps great opportunity for both of us. I will accept your hospitality, and I will tell you everything. Tomorrow, as you say. It cannot come soon enough for me.
It has been my pleasure to make your acquaintance, Master Fairwhite. Don Salvara inclined his head.
May we help your friend up out of the muck, and see you to your inn to ensure you have no further difficulties?
Your company would be most pleasing if only you would wait and look after poor Grauman and our cargo long enough for me to finish my offering within the temple.
Locke removed a small leather pack from the horse's jumble of goods and containers.
The offering will be more substantial than I had planned. But then, my masters understand that prayers of thanks are an unavoidable expense in our line of business.
7. The journey back to the Tumble home was slow, with Jean putting on an excellent show of misery, grogginess, and confusion. If the sight of two mud-splattered, overdressed outlanders and three horses escorted by a don struck anyone as unusual, they kept their comments to themselves and reserved their stares for Don Salvara's back. Along the way, they passed Carlo, now walking about casually in the plain garb of a labourer. He flashed rapid and subtle hand signals. With no sign of bug, he would take up position at one of their prearranged rendezvous sites. And he would pray.
"Lucas! Surely it can't be! I say, Lucas Fairwhite!"
As Carlo vanished into the crowd, Galdo appeared just as suddenly, dressed in the bright silks and cottons of a prosperous Camorri merchant. His slashed and ruffled coat alone was probably worth as much as the barge the gentleman bastards had poled up the river that morning. There was nothing now about him to remind the Don or his man of the alley cutthroats. Unmasked, with his hair slicked back under a small round cap, Galdo was the very picture of physical and fiscal respectability. He twirled a little lacquered cane and stepped toward Don Lorenzo's odd little party, smiling broadly.
"Why, Evante!" Locke, as Fairwhite, stopped and stared in mock astonishment, then held out a hand for a vigorous shake from the newcomer. "What a pleasant surprise!"
"Quite, Lucas, quite. But what the hell's happened to you? And to you, Grauman? You look as though you just lost a fight."
"Ah, we did." Locke looked down and rubbed his eyes. "Evante, it has been a very peculiar morning. Grau and I might not even be alive if not for our rather extraordinary guide here." Pulling Galdo toward him, Locke held a hand out toward the Don. "My Lord Salvara, may I introduce you to Evante Ecari, a solicitor of your Razona district? Evante, this is Don Lorenzo Salvara, of the Nacozza Vineyards, if you still pay attention to those properties."
12 gods!"
Galdo swept his hat off and bowed deeply at the waist.
"A don! I should have recognized you immediately, my lord. 1,000 pardons. Evante Ecari, entirely at your service."
"A pleasure, Master Ecari." Don Salvara bowed correctly but casually, then stepped forward to shake the newcomer's hand. This signaled his permission to deduct any superfluous bowing and scraping from the conversation.
You know Master Fairwhite, then?"
"Lucas and I go well back, my lord."
Without turning his back on Don Salvara, he fussily brushed a bit of dried muck from the shoulders of Locke's black coat.
"I work out of Miraggio's, mostly, handling customers and license work for our friends in the north. Lucas is one of Bel Oster's best and brightest."
"Hardly." Locke coughed and smiled shyly. "Evante takes all the more interesting laws and regulations of your state and reduces them to plain Therin. He was my salvation on several previous ventures. I seem to have a talent for finding snares in Camor, and a talent for finding good Camori to slip me out of them."
"Few clients would describe what I do in such generous terms. But what's this mud and these bruises? You said something of a fight?"
"Yes. Your city has some very, enterprising thieves. Don Salvara and his man have just driven a pair of them off. I fear Grauman and I were getting the worst of the affair."
Galdo stepped over to Jean and gave him a friendly pat on the back. Jean's wince was fantastic theatre.
"My compliments, my Lord Salvara. Lucas is what you might call a good vintage, even if he's not wise enough to take off those silly winter wools. I'm most deeply obligated to you for what you've done, and I'm at—"
"Hardly, sir, hardly."
Don Salvara held up one hand and hitched the other in his sword belt.
"I did what my position demanded, no more. And I have too many promises of obligation being thrown at me already this afternoon."
Don Lorenzo and Master Ecari fenced pleasantries for a few moments thereafter. Galdo eventually let himself be skewered with the politest possible version of "thanks but piss off."
"Well," he said at last, "this has been a wonderful surprise, but I'm afraid I have a client awaiting, and clearly, my Lord Salvara, you and Lucas have business that I shouldn't intrude upon. With your permission?"
"Of course, of course. A pleasure, Master Ecari."
"Entirely mine, I assure you, my lord. Lucas, if you get a spare hour, you know where to find me, and should my poor skills be of any use to your affairs, you know I'll come running."
"Of course, Evante."
Locke grasped Galdo's right hand in both of his and shook enthusiastically.
"I suspect we may have need of you sooner rather than later."
He laid a finger alongside his nose. Galdo nodded, and then there was a general exchange of bows and handshakes and the other courtesies of disentanglement. As Galdo hurried away, he left a few hand signals in his wake, disguised as adjustments to his hat. "I know nothing about bug. Going to look around." Don Salvara stared after him thoughtfully for a few seconds, then turned back to Locke as their small party resumed its journey toward the tumble home. They made small talk for a while. Locke had little trouble, as Fairwhite, letting his pleasure at seeing Ecari slip. Soon he was projecting a very real downcast mood, which he claimed to be an incipient headache from the attempted strangling. Don Salvara and Conte left the two gentleman bastards in front of the Tumble Home's street-side citrus gardens, with admonitions to rest soundly that night and let all business wait for the morrow. No sooner were Locke and Jean safely alone in their suite, the harness full of precious goods thrown back over Jean's shoulders, than they were exploding out of their muddy finery and donning new disguises so they could hurry off to their own rendezvous points to wait for word of Bug, if any was forthcoming. This time, the swift dark shape that flitted silently from rooftop to rooftop in their wake went entirely unnoticed. 8. Fading false light. The hangman's wind and the swamp water mist glued clothes to skin and rapidly congealed Carlo and Galdo's tobacco smoke around them, half cloaking them in a cataract of greyness. The twins sat, hooded and sweating, in the locked doorway of a fairly well-kept pawn shop on the northern tip of the old citadel district. The shop was shuttered and barred for the evening. The keeper's family was obviously drinking something with a merry kick two floors above them.
"It was a good first touch," said Carlo.
"It was, wasn't it?"
"Our best yet. Hard to work all those disguises, what with us being the handsome ones."
"I confess that I wasn't aware we shared that complication."
"Now, now, don't be hard on yourself. Physically, you're quite my match. It's my scholarly gifts you lack, and my easy fearlessness, and my gift for women."
"If you mean the ease with which you drop coins when you're off a-cunting, you're right. You're a one-man charity ball for the whores of Camor."
"Now that," said Carlo, "was genuinely unkind."
"You're right." The twins smoked in silence for a few seconds.
"I'm sorry. Some of the savour's out of it tonight. The little bastard has my stomach twisted in knots. You saw..."
"Extra foot patrols. Pissed off. Yeah. Heard the whistles. I'm real curious about what he did and why he did it."
"He must have had his reasons. If it really was a good first touch, he gave it to us. I hope he's well enough for us to beat the piss out of him."
Stray shapes hurried past in the backlit mist. There was very little elder glass on the old citadel island, so most of the dying glow poured through from a distance. The sound of a horse's hooves on cobbles was coming from the south, and getting louder. At that moment, Locke was no doubt skulking near the Palace of Patience, eyeballing the patrols coming and going across the Black Bridge, making sure that they carried no small familiar prisoners, or small familiar bodies. Jean would be off at another rendezvous point, pacing and cracking his knuckles. Bug would never return straight to the Temple of Perelandro, nor would he go near the Tumble Home. The older gentleman bastards would sit their vigils for him out in the city and the steam. Wooden wheels clattered, and an annoyed animal whinnied. The sound of the horse-drawn cart came to a creaking halt not 20 feet from the Sansa brothers, shrouded in the mist.
"Evendando?"
A loud but uncertain voice spoke the name. Carlo and Galdo leapt to their feet as one. Evendando was their private recognition signal for an unplanned rendezvous.
"Here!"
Carlo cried, dropping his thin cigarette and forgetting to step on it. A man materialized out of the mist, bald and bearded, with the heavy arms of a working artisan and the rounded middle of moderate prosperity.
"I dunno exactly how this works," the man said, "but if one of you is Evendando, I was told I'd have 10 solons for delivering this here cask to this, doorway."
He jerked a thumb over his shoulder toward the cart.
"Cask, indeed!"
Garlo fumbled with a coin purse, heart racing.
"What's, in this cask?"
"Ain't wine," said the stranger. "Ain't a very polite lad, neither, but 10 silvers is what he promised."
"Of course,"
Galdo counted rapidly, slapping bright silver discs down into the man's open palm.
10 for the cask, 1 more for forgetting all about this, hm?
Holy hell! My memory must be cacked out, because I can't remember what you're paying me for.
Good man. Galdo slipped his purse back under his nightcloak and ran to help Carlo, who had mounted the cart and was standing over a wooden cask of moderate size. The cork stopper that would ordinarily be set into the top of the barrel was gone, leaving a small dark air hole. Carlo rapped sharply on the cask three times. Three faint taps came right back. With grins on their faces, the Sansa twins muscled the cask down off the cart and nodded farewell to the driver. The man remounted his cart and soon vanished into the night, whistling, his pockets jingling with more than 20 times the value of the empty cask.
"Well," Carlo said, when they'd rolled the cask back to the shelter of their doorway, "this vintage is probably a little young and rough for decanting. Put it in the cellar for 50 or 60 years? I was thinking we might just pour it in the river."
"Really?" Galdo drummed his fingers on the cask.
"What's the river ever done to deserve that?"
There was a series of noises from inside the cask that sounded vaguely like some sort of protest. Carlo and Galdo leaned down by the air hole together.
"Now, Bug," Carlo began, "I'm sure you have a perfectly good explanation for why you're in there, and why we're out here worrying ourselves sick over you."
"It's a magnificent explanation, really."
Bug's voice was hoarse and echoed faintly.
"You're going to love it. But first, tell me how the game went."
"It was a thing of beauty," said Galdo. 3 weeks tops, and we're going to own this don down to his wife's last set of silk small clothes," added Carlo.
The boy groaned with obvious relief.
"Great! Well, what happened was, there was this pack of yellow jackets heading right for you. What I did to distract them pissed them off pretty fierce, so, I ran for this Cooper's that I know in Old Citadel. He does business with some of the wine places upriver. So he's got this yard of barrels just sitting around. Well, I just sort of invited myself in, jumped in one, and told him that if I could stay there until he delivered me here after false light, there'd be 8 solons in it for him."
"8? Carlo scratched his chin. "The cheeky bastard just asked for 10 and got 11.
"Yeah, well, that's okay,"
Bug coughed.
"I got bored sitting around the cask yard, so I lifted his purse. Had about 2 solons worth of copper in it. So we got some back."
"I was going to say something sympathetic about you lying around inside a cask for half the day," said Galdo. "But that was a damn silly thing to do."
"Oh, come on."
Bug sounded genuinely stung.
"He thought I was in the cask the whole time. So why would he suspect me? And you just gave him a load of money, so why would he suspect you? It's perfect. Locke would appreciate it."
"Bug," Carlo said, "Locke is like a brother to us, and our love for him has no bounds. But the 4 most fatal words in the Therin language are, 'Locke would appreciate it.'" "Rivaled only by 'Locke taught me a new trick,'" added Galdo. "The only person who gets away with Locke Lamora games is Locke Lamora. Because we think the gods are saving him up for a really big death, something with knives and hot irons, and 50,000 cheering spectators."
The brothers cleared their throats in unison.
"Well," Bug said finally, "I did it and I got away with it. Can we go home now?"
"Home," Carlo mused. "Sure. Locke and Jean are going to sob over you like grandmothers when they find out you're alive, so let's not keep them waiting."
"No need to get out. Your legs are probably cramped up," said Galdo.
"They are," Bug squeaked. "But you two really don't need to carry me all that way."
"You've never been more right about anything in your entire life, Bug."
Galdo took up position at one side of the cask and nodded at Carlo.
Whistling in unison, the two brothers began rolling the cask along the cobbles, steering for the temple district, not necessarily by the fastest or smoothest route available. Interlude. Locke explains.
"It was an accident," Locke said at last. "They were both accidents."
"Excuse me, I must not have heard you."
Father Chain's eyes narrowed in the faint red glow of Locke's tiny ceramic lamp.
"I could have sworn you just said, 'Toss me over the parapet. I am a useless little cuss, and I'm ready to die at this very moment.'"
Chains had moved their conversation up to the roof of the temple, where they sat comfortably beneath high parapets meant to be threaded with decorative plants. The long-lost hanging gardens of the House of Perelandro were a small but important aspect of the sacrificial tragedy of the eyeless priest, one more bit of stage-setting to draw sympathy, measured in coins. The clouds had roiled in overhead, palely reflecting the parti-coloured glimmers of night-lit Camor, obscuring the moons and the stars. The hangman's wind was little more than a damp pressure that nudged the sluggish air around Chains and Locke as the boy struggled to clarify himself.
"No, I meant to hurt them, but that's all. I didn't know those things would happen."
"Well, that I can almost believe."
Chains tapped the index finger of his right hand against his left palm, the Camori marketplace gesture for get on with it.
"So take me all the way. That almost is a major problem for you. Make me understand, starting with the first boy."
"Veslin," Locke whispered. "And Gregor. But Veslin first."
"Veslin indeed," Chains said. "Poor soul, got a superfluous orifice carved into his neck by none other than your old master. He had to go buy one of those lovely shark's teeth from the Kappa, and that one got used. So, why?"
"In the hill, some of the older boys and girls stopped going out to work."
Locke wove his fingers tightly together and stared down at them as though they might sprout answers.
"They would just take things when we came back each day, shake us down, make our reports to the master for us, leave things out sometimes."
Chains nodded.
"Privileges of age, size, and ass-kissing. If you survive this conversation, you'll find that it's just the same in most of the big gangs. Most."
"And there was one boy, Veslin. He'd do more. He'd kick us, punch us, take our clothes, make us do things. Lots of times he'd lie to the master about what we'd brought in. He'd give some of our things to the older girls in windows, and all of us in streets would get less food, especially the teasers."
Locke's small hands pulled apart and curled slowly into fists as he spoke.
"And if we tried to tell the master, he just laughed, like he knew about it and thought it was funny. And after we told, Veslin would just get worse."
Chains nodded, then tapped his index finger against his palm once more.
"I thought about it. I thought about it a lot. None of us could fight him. He was too big. None of us had any big friends in the hill. And if we ganged up on Veslin, his big friends would all come after us." "Veslin went out each day with some of his friends. We saw them while we were working. They wouldn't mess with our jobs, but they would watch us, you know. And Veslin would say things."
Locke's thin-lipped scowl would have been comical on a less dirty, less emaciated, less hollow-eyed boy. As it was, he looked like a slender wall gargoyle, working himself up for a pounce.
"Say things when we came back, about how we were clumsy or lazy and not taking enough. And he would push us more, and hit us more, and cheat us more. I thought and I thought and I thought about what to do."
"And the idea," said Chains, "the fateful idea, was it all yours?"
"Yes," the boy nodded vigorously, "all mine. I was alone when I had the idea. I saw some yellow jackets on patrol, and I thought about their sticks and their swords.
And I thought, what if they beat up Veslin? What if they had some reason not to like him?
Locke paused for breath.
And I thought more, but I couldn't work it. I didn't know how. But then I thought, what if they weren't angry with Veslin? What if I use them as an excuse to make the master angry with Veslin?
Chains nodded sagely. And where did you get the white iron coin?
Locke sighed. Streets. All of us who didn't like Veslin stole extra. We watched and we clutched and we worked hard. It took weeks. It took forever. I wanted white iron. I finally got one from a fat man dressed all in black wool. Funny coats and ties.
A Vadran.
Chains seemed bemused.
Probably a merchant come down to do some business. Too proud to dress for the weather at first, and sometimes too cheap to see a tailor in town. So you got a white iron coin, a full crown.
Everyone wanted to see it. Everyone wanted to touch it. I let them. Then I made them be quiet. I made them promise not to talk about it. I told them it was how we were going to get Veslin.
So what did you do with your coin?
Put it in a purse, a little leather purse, the kind we clutched all the time, and hid it out in the city so it wouldn't get taken from us, a place we knew about where nobody big could get to. And I made sure that Veslin and his friends were out of the hill, and I got the coin, and I went back in early one day. I gave up coppers and bread to the older girls on the door, but the coin was in my shoe.
Here Locke paused and fiddled with his little lamp, making the red glow waver on his face.
I put it in Veslin's room, the one where he and Gregor slept, one of the nice dry tombs, center of the hill. I found a loose stone and hid the purse there, and when I was sure nobody had seen me, I asked to see the master. I said that some of us had seen Veslin at one of the Yellowjacket stations, that he'd taken money from them, that he'd shown it to us, and said that if we told on him, he'd sell us to the Yellowjackets.
Amazing. Chains scratched his beard. You know you don't mumble and stutter quite so much when you're explaining how you fucked someone over?
Locke blinked, then turned his chin up and stared hard at Chains. The older man laughed.
Wasn't a criticism, son, and I didn't mean to dam the flow. Keep the story coming. How did you know your old master would take offense at this? Did the Yellow Jackets ever offer you or your friends money?
No, Locke said. No, but I knew the master gave them money. For favors, for information. We saw him putting coins in purses sometimes. So I figured maybe I could work it the other way.
Ah.
Chains reached within the folds of his robe and withdrew a flat leather wallet, the color of baked bricks in the light of Locke's lamp. From this he withdrew a scrap of paper, onto which he shook a dark powder from another corner of the wallet. This object he rapidly folded, end over end, until it was a tight cylinder, and with courtly grace he lit one end by holding it in the lamp's flame. Soon he was sending ghostly grey swirls of smoke up to join the ghostly grey clouds. The stuff smelled like burning pine tar.
"Forgive me,"
Chains said, shifting his bulk to his right, so his direct exhalations would miss the boy by a few feet.
"Two smokes a night is all I let myself have. The rough stuff before dinner and the smooth stuff after. Makes everything taste better."
"So I'm staying for dinner?"
"Oho, my cheeky little opportunist. Let's say the situation remains fluid. You go ahead and finish your story. You tipped your old master that Veslin was working as an auxiliary member of the famed Camor Constabulary. He must have thrown quite a fit."
"He said he'd kill me if I was lying."
Locke scuttled to his own right, even farther from the smoke.
"But I said he'd had the coin in his room, his and Gregor's. So he tore it apart. I hid the coin real well, but he found it. He was supposed to."
"What did you expect to happen then?"
I didn't know they'd get killed.
Chains couldn't hear any real grief in that soft and passionate little voice, but there seemed to be real puzzlement, real aggravation.
I wanted to beat Veslin. I thought maybe he'd do him up in front of all of us. We ate together most nights, the whole hill. Fuck-ups had to do tricks or serve and clean everything, sometimes get held down for caning. Drink ginger oil. I thought he'd get those things, maybe all those things.
Well, Chains held an inhalation of smoke for a particularly long moment, as though the tobacco could fill him with insight, and looked away from Locke. When he finally exhaled, he did so in little puffs, forming wobbly crescents that fluttered a few feet and faded into the general haze. He harumphed and turned back to the boy.
Well, you certainly learned the value of good intentions, didn't you? Caning, cleaning and serving. Poor Veslin got cleaned and served, all right. How did your old master do it?
He was gone for a few hours, and when he came back, he waited, in Veslin's room. When Veslin and Gregor came back that night, there were older boys nearby, so they couldn't go anywhere. And then, the master just killed them, both, cut Veslin's throat, and some of the others said he looked at Gregor for a while, and he didn't say anything, and then he just...
Locke made the same sort of jabbing motion with two fingers that Chains had made at him earlier.
He did Gregor, too.
Of course he did. Poor Gregor. Gregor Foss, wasn't it? One of those lucky little orphans old enough to remember his last name. Not unlike yourself. Of course your old master did him, too. He and Veslin were best friends, right? Two draughts from the same bottle. It was an elementary assumption that one would know that the other was hiding a fortune under a rock.
Chains sighed and rubbed his eyes.
Elementary. So, now that you've told your part, would you like me to point out where you fucked everything up? And to let you know why most of your little friends in streets that helped you pluck that white iron coin are going to be dead before morning?
Chapter 2. Second Touch at the Teeth Show. Idler's Day, the 11th hour of the morning at the Shifting Revel. The sun was once again the baleful white of a diamond and a fire, burning an arc across the empty sky and pouring down heat that could be felt against the skin. Locke stood beneath the silk awning atop Don Salvara's pleasure barge, dressed in the clothes and mannerisms of Lucas Fairwhite, and stared out at the gathering revel. There was a troop of rope dancers perched atop a platform boat to his left, four of them standing in a diamond pattern about 15 feet apart. Great lengths of brightly coloured silk rope stretched amongst the dancers around their arms and chests and necks. It seemed that each dancer was working 4 or 5 strands simultaneously. These strands formed an ever-shifting cat's cradle between the dancers, and suspended in this web by clever hitches were all manner of small objects, swords, knives, overcoats, boots, glass statuettes, sparkling knick-knacks. All these objects were slowly but gradually moving in various directions as the dancers twirled arms and shifted hips, slipping old knots loose and forming newer, tighter ones with impossibly smooth gestures. It was a minor wonder on a busy river of wonders, not the least of which was Don and Doña Salvara's barge. While many nobles hauled trees to and from their orchards on the water, Locke's hosts were the first to go one step further. Their pleasure barge was a permanent floating orchard in miniature. Perhaps 50 paces long and 20 wide, it was a double-hulled wooden rectangle stuffed with soil to support a dozen oak and olive trees. Their trunks were a uniform night black, and their rustling cascades of leaves were unnatural emerald, bright as lacquer, an outward testimony to the subtle science of alchemical botany. Wide circular stairs, crisscrossed with patches of leafy shade, wound up several of these trees, leading to the Don's silk-topped observation box, comfortably perched within the branches to give the occupants an unobstructed forward view. On each side of this supremely ostentatious sliver of floating forest were 20 hard rowers, seated on outrigger-like structures that kept the top-heavy central portion of the yacht from plunging sideways. The box could easily hold 20. This morning it held only Locke and Jean, the Don and the Donya, and the ever-watchful Conte, currently tending a liquor cabinet so elaborate it might have been mistaken for an apothecary's lab. Locke returned his gaze to the rope dancers, feeling a strange kinship with them. They weren't the only ones with ample opportunity to screw up a delicate public act this morning.
"Master Fairwhite, your clothes!"
Doña Sofia Salvara shared the forward rail of the observation box with him, her hands scant inches from his.
"You would look so very fine in one of your Emberlane winters, but why must you suffer them in our summer? You shall sweat yourself as red as a rose. Might you not take something off?"
My lady, I assure you, most comfortable."
13 gods, she was actually flirting with him, and the little smile that crept on and off her husband's face told Locke that the Salvaras had planned this in advance. A little close feminine attention to fluster the awkward master merchant, perfectly staged and perfectly common. A game before the game, so to speak.
"I find that whatever discomfort these clothes bring me in your very interesting climate only serves to goad me into concentrating. Keeps me alert, you see. A better, man of business."
Jean, standing a few paces behind the two of them, bit his tongue. Throwing blondes at Locke Lamora was not unlike throwing lettuce at sharks, and the Doña Sofia was very blonde. One of those gorgeous Therin rarities with skin like burnt amber and hair the colour of almond butter. Her eyes were deep and steady, her curves artfully not concealed by a dark orange summer dress with a cream-white underskirt barely showing at the hem. Well, it was just the Salvara's luck to run up against a thief with the most peculiar damned taste in women. Jean could admire the Doña for them both. His limited role today, and his injuries, would give him little else to do.
"Our master Fairwhite is made of unusually stern stuff, my dear."
Don Lorenzo lounged in a far corner of the forward rail, dressed in loose white silks and an orange vest matching his wife's dress. His white neckerchief hung rakishly loose, and only the bottom clasp of his vest was fastened.
"Yesterday he took the beating of a lifetime. Today he wears enough wool for 5 men and dares the sun to do its worst. I must say I'm more and more pleased with myself that I've kept you out of Jacopo's grasp, Lucas."
Locke acknowledged the smiling Don with a slight bow and an agreeably awkward smile of his own.
"Do at least have something to drink, Master Fairwhite."
Doña Sofia's hand briefly settled over Locke's, long enough for him to feel the assorted calluses and chemical burns no manicure could conceal. She was a true alchemical botanist, then. This barge was her direct handiwork as well as her general design. A formidable talent, by implication a calculating woman. Lorenzo was obviously the more impulsive one, and if he was wise, he'd weigh his wife's opinion before agreeing to any of Lucas Fairwhite's proposals. Locke therefore favoured her with a shy smile and an awkward cough. Let her think she was getting to him.
"A drink would be very pleasing," he said. "But, I fear that you shall have no reassurance for my condition, kind Doña Sofia. I have done much business in your city. I know how drinking is done here when men and women speak of business."
"Mornings for sweat and nights for regret," Don Salvara said as he stepped from the rail and gestured to his servant. "Conte, I do believe Master Fairwhite has just requested nothing less than a ginger scald."
Conte moved adroitly to fill this request, first selecting a tall crystal wine flute, into which he poured 2 fingers of purest Camori ginger oil, the colour of scorched cinnamon. To this he added a sizable splash of milky pear brandy, followed by a transparent heavy liquor called Argento, which was actually a cooking wine flavoured with radishes. When this cocktail was mixed, Conte wrapped a wet towel around the fingers of his left hand and reached for a covered brazier smouldering to the side of the liquor cabinet. He withdrew a slender metal rod, glowing orange-red at the tip, and plunged it into the cocktail. There was an audible hiss and a small puff of spicy steam. Once the rod was stanched, Conte stirred the drink briskly and precisely 3 times, then presented it to Locke on a thin silver plate. Locke had practiced this ritual many times over the years, but when the cold burn of the ginger scald hit his lips, limning every tiny crack with stinging heat and outlining every crevice between teeth and gums in exquisite pain, even before it went to work on tongue and throat, he was never able to fully hold back the memories of Shades Hill and of the thief-maker's admonishments, of a liquid fire that seemed to creep up his sinuses and burn behind his eyes until he wanted to tear them out. Expressing discomfort at his first sip of the drink was much easier than feigning interest in the Doña.
"Incomparable!" He coughed, and then, with quick, jerky motions, he loosened his black neckcloths just the slightest bit. The Salvaras smirked charmingly together. "I'm reminded again why I have such success selling gentler liquors to you people."
2. Once per month there was no trading done in the shifting market. Every 4th idler's day the merchants stayed clear of the great sheltered circle abutting the Angevin River. Instead they drifted or anchored nearby while half the city came out to see the shifting revel. Camor had never possessed a great stone or elderglass amphitheatre, and had fallen instead into the curious custom of rebuilding its spectator circle anew at each revel. Huge, multi-storied observation barges were towed out and anchored firmly against the stone breakwaters surrounding the shifting market, like floating slices cut from the heart of great stadiums. Each barge was operated by a rival family or merchant combine and decked in unique livery. They competed fiercely with one another to fill their seats, and inter-vessel brawls between the habitual customers of particularly beloved barges were not unknown. When properly aligned, these barges formed an arc about halfway around the circumference of the shifting market. A channel was left clear for boats entering and leaving the center of the calm water, and the rest of the periphery was reserved for the pleasure barges of the nobility. A good 100 or so could be counted on at any revel, and half again as many for major festivals such as this one. Less than 3 weeks remained until the midsummer mark and the Day of Changes. Even before the entertainments began, the shifting revel was its own spectacle, a great tide of rich and poor, floating and on foot, jostling for position in a traditional contest much loved for its lack of rules. The yellow jackets were always out in force, but more to prevent hard words and fisticuffs from escalating than to prevent disturbances altogether. The revel was a city-wide debauch, a rowdy public service the Duke was happy to underwrite from his treasury. There were few things like a good revel to pull the fangs from any unrest before it had time to fester. Feeling the fire of the approaching noon, despite the silk awning over their heads, Locke and his hosts compounded their situation by drinking ginger scalds as they stared out across the rippling heat haze at thousands of Camorri packing the commoner barges. Conte had prepared identical drinks for his lord and lady, though with a touch less ginger oil, perhaps, which Graumann had served them, as Camorri etiquette dictated in these situations. Locke's glass was half empty. The liquor was a ball of expanding warmth in his stomach and a vivid memory in his throat.
"Business," he said at last. "You have both been so kind to Grau and myself. I agreed to repay this kindness by revealing my business here in Camor, so let us speak of it, if that would please you."
"You have never had a more eager audience in your life, Master Fairwhite."
The Don's hired rowers were bringing them into the shifting revel proper, and closing on dozens of more traditional pleasure barges, some of them crammed with dozens or hundreds of guests,
The Don's eyes were alive with greedy curiosity. "Tell on."
"The Kingdom of the Seven Marrows is coming apart at the seams."
Locke sighed.
"This is no secret."
The Don and the Donya nonchalantly sipped their drinks, saying nothing.
"The Canton of Emberlane is peripheral to the major conflict, but the Graf von Emberlane and the Black Table are both working, in different directions, to place it in the way of substantial harm."
"The Black Table?" asked the Don.
"I beg pardon."
Locke took the tiniest sip of his drink and let new fire trickle under his tongue.
"The Black Table is what we call the Council of Emberlane's most powerful merchants. My masters of the House of Bel-Oster are among them. In every respect save the military and the matter of taxes, they run the Canton of Emberlane. And they are tired of the Graf, and tired of the trade guilds in the other six cantons of the Marrows, tired of limitations. Emberlane grows rich on new means of speculation and enterprise. The Black Table sees the old guilds as a weight around their neck."
"Curious," said the Donya, "that you say there and not our. Is this significant?"
"To a point."
Another sip of the drink, a second of feigned nervousness.
"The House of Bel-Oster agrees that the guilds have outlasted their usefulness, that the trade practices of centuries past should not be set in stone by guild law. We do not necessarily agree."
He sipped the drink yet again and scratched the back of his head.
"That the Graf von Emberlane should be deposed while he is out of the canton with most of his army, showing his flag on behalf of his cousins in Parley and Somne."
"Holy 12!" Don Salvara shook his head as though to clear it of what he'd just heard. "They can't be serious. Your state is smaller than the Duchy of Camorre, exposed to the sea on two sides. Impossible to defend."
"And yet the preparations are underway. Emberlane's banks and merchant houses do four times the yearly business of the next richest canton in the Marrows. The Black Table fixates upon this. Gold should certainly be considered potential power. The Black Table errs by imagining it to be direct power in and of itself."
He finished his drink in one long, deliberate draught.
"In 2 months, civil war will have broken out anyway. The succession is a mess. The Stradas and the Dvorims, the Razuls and the Strigs, they are all sharpening knives and parading men. Yet, as we speak, the merchants of Emberlane are moving to arrest the remaining nobility while the Graf is away, to claim the navy, to raise a levy of free citizens, to hire mercenaries. In short, they will now attempt to secede from the Marrows. It is unavoidable."
"And what specifically does this have to do with you coming here?"
The Donya's knuckles were white around her wine flute. She grasped the full significance of Fairwhite's story. A fight larger than anything seen in centuries. Civil war mixed with possible economic disaster.
"It is the opinion of my masters, the House of Bel-Oster, that rats in the hold have little chance to take the wheel of a ship that is about to run aground. But those same rats may very easily abandon the ship."
3. In the center of the shifting revel, a great many tall iron cages had been sunk into the water. Some of these served to support wooden slats on which performers, victims, fighters, and attendants could stand. A few particularly heavy cages restrained dark shapes that circled ominously under the translucent grey water. Platform boats were rowed around at a steady clip, showing off rope dancers, knife-throwers, acrobats, jugglers, strongmen, and other curiosities. The excited shouts of barkers with long brass speaking trumpets echoed flatly off the water. First up at any revel were the penance bouts, where petty offenders from the Palace of Patience could volunteer for mismatch combat in exchange for reduced sentences or slightly improved living conditions. At present, a hugely muscled Nicovezzo, punishing hand, one of the Duke's own household guard, was handing out the beatings. The soldier was armoured in black leather, with a gleaming steel breastplate and a steel helmet crested with the freshly severed fin of a giant flying fish. Scales and spines scintillated as the soldier stepped back and forth under the bright sun, striking out seemingly at leisure with an iron-shod staff. The Nicovezzo stood on a platform that was small but rock-steady. A series of circular wooden flats surrounded him, separated by an arm's-length span of water. These wobbly, unstable platforms were occupied by about 2 dozen slender, grimy prisoners, each armed with a small wooden cudgel. A concerted rush might have overwhelmed their armored tormentor, but this lot seemed to lack the temperament for cooperation. Approaching the Nicovezzo singly or in little groups, they were being dropped one after another with skull-rattling blows. Little boats circled to fish out unconscious prisoners before they slipped under the water forever. The Duke, in his mercy, did not allow penance bouts to be deliberately lethal. Locke held his empty wine flute out for just a second. Conte plucked it out of his fingers with the grace of a swordsman disarming an opponent. When the Don's manservant stepped toward the liquor cabinet, Locke cleared his throat. "No need to refill that particular glass just yet, Conte. Too kind, too kind. But with your permission, my lord and Lady Salvara, I should like to offer a pair of gifts. One as a matter of simple hospitality, the other as a... well, you'll see. Grauman?" Locke snapped his fingers, and Jean nodded. The heavy-set man moved over to a wooden table just beside the liquor cabinet and picked up 2 heavy leather satchels, each of which had iron-reinforced corners and small iron locks sewn into their covers. Jean set these down where the Salvaras could easily see them, and then stepped back so Locke could unseal the satchels with a delicate key of carved ivory. From the first satchel he withdrew a cask of pale aromatic wood, perhaps 1 foot in height and half that in diameter, which he then held out for Don Salvara's examination. A plain black brand on the surface of the cask read, "Brandvin Osterschalin 502. Don Lorenzo's breath hissed in between his teeth. Perhaps his nostrils even flared, though Locke kept the face of Lucas Fairwhite politely neutral. 12 gods, a 502! Lucas, if I seem to be teasing you for your refusal to part with your goods, please accept my deepest—" "You needn't apologize, my lord." Locke held up a hand and mimicked the Don's gesture for shooing words down out of the air. "For your bold intervention on my behalf, Don Salvara, and for your excellent hospitality this morning, fair Doña, please accept this minor ornament for your cellars."
"Minor?"
The Don took the cask and cradled it as though it were an infant not 5 minutes born.
I have a 506 and a pair of 504s. I don't know of anyone in Camor that has a 502, except probably the Duke."
"Well," said Locke, "my masters have kept a few on hand ever since the word got out that it was a particularly good blend. We use them to break the ice in matters of grave business importance."
In truth, that cask represented an investment of nearly 800 full crowns and a sea trip up the coast to Ashmere, where Locke and Jean had contrived to win it from an eccentric minor noble in a rigged card game. Most of the money had actually gone to evade or buy off the assassins the old man had later sent after his property. The 502 vintage had become almost too precious to drink.
"What a grand gesture, Master Fairwhite."
Doña Sofia slipped a hand through the crook of her husband's elbow and gave him a possessive grin.
"Lorenzo, love, you should try to rescue strangers from Emberlane more often. They're so charming."
Locke coughed and shuffled his feet.
Hardly, my lady. Now, Don Salvara,
please, do call me Lorenzo.
Don Lorenzo, what I have to show you next relates rather directly to my reason for coming here. From the second satchel he drew out a similar cask, but this one was marked only with a stylized A within a circle of vines.
This, said Locke, is a sample drawn from last year's distillation, the 559.
Don Salvara dropped the cask of 502. The Doña, with girlish agility, shot out her right foot to hook the cask in mid-air and let it down to the deck with a slight thump rather than a splintering crash. Unbalanced, she did manage to drop her ginger scald. The glass vanished over the side and was soon 20 feet under water. The Salvaras steadied one another, and the Don picked his cask of 502 back up, his hands shaking.
"Lucas," he said, "surely, surely you must be kidding."
4. Locke didn't find it particularly easy to eat lunch while watching a dozen swimming men being pulled apart by a Gerishti devilfish, but he decided that his master merchant of Emberlane had probably seen worse in his many imaginary sea voyages, and he kept his true feelings far from his face. Noon was well past, the penance bouts were over, and the revel masters had moved on to the judicial forfeitures. This was a polite way of saying that the men in the water were murderers, rapists, slavers, and arsonists, selected to be colourfully executed for the amusement of the revel crowds. Technically speaking, they were armed and would receive lesser sentences if they could somehow contrive to slay whatever beast they were matched against, but the beasts were always as nasty as their weapons were laughable, so mostly they were just executed. The devilfish's tentacles were 12 feet long, the same length as its undulating grey and black striped body. The creature was confined within a 60-foot circle of cages and platforms, along with a number of screaming, flailing, water-treading men, most of whom had long since dropped their slender little daggers into the water. Nervous guards, armed with crossbows and pikes, patrolled the platform, shoving prisoners back into the water if they tried to scramble out. Occasionally the devilfish would roll over in the churning red waters, and Locke would catch a glimpse of one lidless black eye the size of a soup bowl, not unlike the bowl currently held in his hands.
"More, Master Fairwhite?"
Conte hovered nearby with the silver tureen of chilled soup cradled in his hands. White-fleshed iron sea prawns floated in a heavy red tomato base seasoned with peppers and onions. Don and Doña Salvara were a peculiar sort of droll.
"No, Conte, most kind, but I'm well satisfied for the time being."
Locke set his soup bowl down beside the broached cask of 559, actually a bottle of lowly 50-crown 550 liberally mixed with the roughest overpriced rum Jean had been able to get his hands on, and took a sip of the amber liquor from his snifter. Even mixed with crap, the counterfeit was delicious. Grauman stood attentively behind Locke's hosts, who were seated opposite Locke at the intimate little table of oiled silverwood. Doña Sofia toyed unself-consciously with a subtlety of gelled orange slices, paper-thin and arranged in whorls to form edible tulip blossoms. Don Lorenzo stared down at the snifter of brandy in his hands, his eyes still wide.
"It seems almost sacrilegious."
Despite this sentiment, the Don took a deep gulp of the stuff, satisfaction well evident in the lines of his face. In the distance behind him, something that might have been a severed torso flew up into the air and came back down with a splash. The crowd roared approval. Osterschalin brandy was famously aged for a minimum of 7 years after distillation and blending. It was impossible for outsiders to get their hands on a cask any sooner than that. The house of Bell Oster's factors were forbidden even to speak of the batches that were not yet on sale. The location of the vintners' aging houses was a secret that was reportedly guarded by assassination when necessary. Don Lorenzo had been struck stupid when Locke had casually offered up a cask of 559. He had nearly thrown up when Locke had just as casually opened the seal and suggested they share it with lunch.
"It is," Locke chuckled. "The brandy is the religion of my house. So many rules, so many rituals, so many penalties."
No longer smiling, he drew a quick finger across his throat.
"It's possible we're the only people in history to have an unaged sample with a lunch of soup. I thought you might enjoy it."
"I am." The Don swirled the liquor in his glass and stared at it, as though hypnotized by the soft caramel-colored translucence. "And I'm dead serious about what sort of scheme you've got up your sleeve, Lucas."
"Well," Locke swirled his own drink theatrically, "there have been 3 invasions of Emberlane in the past 250 years. Let's be frank. The succession rights of the Kingdom of the Marrows always involves armies and blood before they involve blessings and banquets. When the Grafs quarrel, the Ostershalin Mountains are only landward barrier and the site of heavy fighting. This fighting inevitably spills down the eastern slopes of the mountains, right through the vineyards of the House of Bel Oster. How could it be different this time? Thousands of men and horses coming over the passes, trampling the vineyards, sacking everything in sight. It might even be worse now that we have fire oil. Our vineyards could be ashes half a year from now."
"You can't exactly pack your vineyards up and take them with you if you jump ship," said Don Lorenzo.
"No," Locke sighed. "It's the Ostershalin soils, in part, that make Ostershalin brandy. If we lose those vineyards, it will be just as it was before, an interruption of growth and distillation. 10, 20, maybe even 30 years, or more. And it gets worse. Our position is terrible. The Graf can't let Emberlane's ports and revenue go if the Marrows are coming to civil war. He and his allies will storm the place as fast as possible. They'll likely put the Black Table to the sword, impound their goods and properties, nationalize their funds. The House of Bel Oster won't be spared. At the moment, the Black Table is acting quietly but firmly. Grau and I sailed 5 days ago, just 12 hours before we knew the port would be sealed off. No Emberlane-flagged ships are being allowed out. They're all being docked and secured for repairs or quarantine. Nobles still loyal to the Graf are under house arrest by now, their guards disarmed. Our funds in various lending houses of Emberlane have been temporarily frozen. All the Black Table merchant houses have consented to do this to one another. It makes it impossible for any house to flee en masse with its gold and its goods. Currently, Grau and I are operating on our local credit line, established at Maraggio's years ago. My house, well, we simply didn't keep our funds outside Emberlane, just a bit here and there for emergencies.
Locke watched the Salvaras very closely for their reaction. His news from Emberlane was as fresh and specific as possible, but the Don might have sources of intelligence the gentleman bastards hadn't spotted in their weeks of surveillance and preparation. The parts about the Black Table and the impending civil war were solid, educated speculation. The part about a sudden port closure and house arrests was pure homespun bullshit. In Locke's estimation, the real mess in Emberlane wouldn't start for a few months. If the Don was wise to this, the game might be blown. Conte might be trying to pin Locke to the table with his daggers in just a few seconds. And then Jean would pull out the hatchets he had concealed down the back of his vest, and everyone in the little group beneath the silk awning would get very, very uncomfortable. But the Salvaras said nothing. They merely continued to stare at him with eyes that plainly invited him to go on. Emboldened, he continued.
"This situation is unbearable. We will neither be hostages to a cause that we barely profess, nor victims for the Graf's vengeance upon his inevitable return. We choose a somewhat risky alternative, one that would require substantial aid from a noble of Camor.
You, Don Salvara, if it is within your means."
The Don and his wife had clasped hands under the table. He waved his hand at Locke excitedly.
"We can surrender our funds. By taking no steps to secure them, we buy ourselves more time to act. And we are quite confident that replacing those funds will merely be a matter of time and effort. We can even abandon..." Locke gritted his teeth. "We can even abandon our vineyards. We will completely burn them ourselves, leaving nothing to anyone else. After all, we enhance the soil ourselves, alchemically, and the secret of that enhancement is kept only in the hearts of our planting masters."
"The Osterschalin process," Sophia breathed, betrayed by her own rising excitement.
"Of course, you've heard of it. Well, there are only 3 planting masters at any given time, and the process is complex enough to defy soil examination, even by someone with talents such as yours, my lady. Many of the compounds our alchemists use are inert, and intended only to confuse the matter. So that's that. The one thing we cannot abandon is our stock of aging blends, the last 6 years batched in their casks, and certain rare vintages and special experiments. We store the Osterschalin in 32-gallon casks. There are nearly 6,000 such casks in our possession. We have to get them out of Emberlane. We have to do it in the next few weeks, before the Black Table imposes harsher control measures, and before the Graf begins laying siege to his canton. And now our ships are under guard, and all of our funds are untouchable."
You want to get all of these casks out of Emberlane? All of them?" The Don actually gulped.
"As many as possible," said Locke.
"And for this you would involve us how?" Doña Sophia was fidgeting.
"Emberlane flagged ships can no longer leave port, nor enter if they wish to escape again, but a small flotilla of Camorre-flagged ships with Camorre crews financed by a Camorre noble..."
Locke set his glass of brandy down and spread both his hands in the air. "You wish me to provide a naval expedition?"
"2 or 3 of your larger galleons should do it. We're looking at 1,000 tons of cargo, casks and brandy alike. Minimal crew, say 50 or 60 men a ship. We can take our pick of the docks and get sober, trustworthy captains. 6 or 7 days beating north, plus however long it takes to scratch the crews and ships together. I guess less than a week. Do you concur?"
"A week, yes, but you're asking me to finance all of this?"
"In exchange for a most handsome recompense, I assure you."
"Provided everything goes well, yes, and we'll come to the matter of recompense in a moment, but just the rapid acquisition of 2 galleons, good captains, and very reliable crews..."
"Plus," said Locke, "something to stick in the hold for the trip north. Cheap grain, dried cheese, low-grade fresh fruit, nothing special. But Emberlane will shortly be under siege. The Black Table will be happy to have a cache of extra supplies offloaded. Emberlane's position is too tenuous to fail to respect the sovereign neutrality of Camorre. That's what my masters are counting on to get the ships in and out. But added assurance cannot hurt."
"Yes," said Don Lorenzo, tugging on his lower lip. 2 galleons, crews, officers, cheap cargo. A small crew of mercenaries, 10 or 12 a ship. There are always some hanging around the Viscount's gate this time of year. I'd want a hard corps of armed men on each ship to discourage complications."
Locke nodded.
"So how exactly would we go about removing the casks from your aging houses and transporting them to the docks?"
"A very simple ruse," said Locke.